Is there clear evidence the CIA and FBI were trying to recruit two of the 9/11 hijackers? Did the Israeli stock market detect strange behavior in advance of the October 7th attacks on Israel, similar to the put options in American and United Airlines stock before the 9/11 attacks? Is there clear evidence that Zionist entities may have been involved in directing incitations to Islamophobic violence in Great Britain last month? Do journalists and other individuals contradicting the Ukraine war and other state-driven narratives face brutal treatment by the British state well beyond the dreams of the McCarthy era? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we analyze major news stories today while taking a look at what has been missed or totally forgotten in major news dialogue, examining the 9/11 attacks, the attack on Israel nearly a year ago, and more. Our guest for the hour will be the phenomenal, award-winning investigative journalist, Kit Clarenberg. On this week's program, examining the role of intelligence services in shaping politics and perceptions, and the price we may pay, with Kit Clarenberg. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of September 13th, 2024. The program is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization, produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our shows are available to partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. We acknowledge that this was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Ojibwe, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation, the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. Settlers who came to this land in recent centuries attained the abundant assets and resources largely by taking advantage of the indigenous people who were here first through false promises, broken treaties, and even by force. As descendants, in the spirit of truth and reconciliation, we should seek to correct this unbalanced approach and share the land with mutual and sincere respect. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Commander Cornelis van der Klauw from Royal Netherlands Navy and expert from Strategic Communications and Information Operations NATO Joint Warfare Center wrote in an article in 2023, quote, "The reason why cognitive attacks go unnoticed by their targets is that cognitive activities bypass the conscious mind and directly target the subconscious of a person. Most of our decisions are made by our subconscious. Cognitive attacks are aimed at exploiting emotions rooted in our subconscious, bypassing our rational conscious mind," unquote. As a result, we are living in the world where democratic states base their ideology on the policy of human rights defense, but at the same time, they keep in secret the weapons which can be used to eliminate human rights and abolish even the right to freedom of thought, and consequently the democracy itself. Since the voters' behavior can be controlled by governments at the time of elections. For as long as those weapons are not declassified, there will be no guarantee that they will not be used against citizens and that democracy will remain a ruling political system in the Western world. That comes from the article, Remote Control of the Human Brain, Crowd Control Technologies, High-Risk AI Systems, Can We Preserve Democracy and Human Rights? Mojmir Babacek, by Mojmir Babacek, posted September 12th. Today, the news reports that opposition leader Edmundo González has fled to Spain after an arrest warrant. A lot is being kept quiet about this. For example, the far right, another quote-unquote detail, which the media modestly keep quiet about,
Gonzalez was the only one of the 9 opposition candidates who refused in advance to recognize the results of the elections. Nor do the media report that these elections were conducted according to a strict scenario with the intention of provoking a violent popular uprising and implementing a regime change in case the far right lost. By not recognizing the results and publishing fake results, Gonzalez provoked riots the day after the elections. That comes from the article, Why So Much Media Attention for Venezuela? Quote-unquote elected versus quote-unquote unelected presidents Latin America. Violent regime change by Mark Van de Pit, posted September 12th. Anything perceived to be a weapon can be seized, with officers having powers to request that civilians reveal their identity. Despite such exercisable powers, the relevant legislation imposes a time limit of 12 hours for such areas, something most conspicuously breached by the commissioner. But as Melbourne activist Legal Support, or MALS, group remarks, the broader criteria outlined in the legislative regime are often not met and constitute a, quote, method of protest control, unquote, that impairs, quote, the rights to assembly, association, and political expression, unquote, protected by the Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. The Victorian government had little time for the language of protest. In a stunningly grotesque twist, the Victorian Premier, Jacinta Allan, defended those at the Land Forces Conference as legitimate representatives of business engaging in a peaceful enterprise. That comes from the article, Protecting the Merchants of Death, the Australian Police Effort for Land Forces 2024, by Dr. Binoy Campmark, posted September 12th. Germany provided 30% of Israel's arms between 2019 to 2023, and its exports to Israel in 2023 were worth 326.5 million euros, having increased tenfold from the previous year, with the vast majority of licenses being approved after 7th of October. Moreover, much of the weaponry supplied by the U.S. is fitted out with European-manufactured components. In addition, EU member states facilitate the transit of U.S. arms shipments through their territory on the way to Israel. For years, Israeli entities have been given a free rein to access EU research funding, even though those in receipt of this money are often directly connected to Israel's apartheid state and military apparatus. This has continued since 7th of October, with at least 2 research projects directly funding Israel Aerospace Industries, or IAI, one of Israel's largest arms companies. That comes from the article EU Complicity in Israel's Genocidal War on Gaza, by Nimni Brian, posted September 12th, originally published on Socialist Voice. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Kit Clarenberg has become renowned in recent years for his work as an investigative journalist exposing state crimes against democracy. He's published on Mint Press News, The Gray Zone, and kitclarenberg.com, and has a video outlet called Active Measures. He was an honoree for the Indie Media Award in 2022. I welcomed him to the show and then started asking questions about some of the remarkable stories he had been exploring over the last year, beginning with one on the 9/11 attacks?
There were people within, I guess you could call it the 9/11 truth movement, although I mean, I don't personally consider myself a member of any movement, apart from the Movement for Humanity, perhaps. But yeah, in effect, for years, people, independent researchers and journalists had been raising very obvious questions about whether the CIA had a relationship with some of the hijackers via the Saudi intelligence services, not least because of the very strange confirmed behaviour by the CIA around the two hijackers you mentioned, which is Hazmi and Midar. So they entered the US despite the fact that they, the CIA and NSA knew that they were coming. They shouldn't have been allowed to get in the first place. And they had multi-entry visas to the US. And when they landed, the numerous FBI officials who were... So, okay, I mean, just a bit of background. There was something called Alec Station, which was the CIA's Bin Laden, anti-Bin Laden and anti-Al-Qaeda unit. Now, this had FBI agents posted to it. They, when they found out that Hazmi and Midar were members of Al-Qaeda and who were flagged as potentially very dangerous terrorists, said, we want to inform our superiors in FBI headquarters about this, and they were blocked. They were consistently blocked from doing so. And there are all sorts of indications that Alec Station sought to obfuscate and mislead the FBI about the presence of these two known Al-Qaeda operatives on US soil. Now, not long after arrival, as in within minutes of their arrival at Los Angeles International Airport, they bump into, apparently by happenstance, Omar al-Bayoumi, who is this kind of very shady Saudi government employee who doesn't seem to have done much very obvious work for the Saudi government, but it appears was receiving an enormous amount of money from the House of Saud. Now, the FBI, years later, set up something called Operation Encore, which was an investigation into potential Saudi connections to the 9/11 attacks. And they concluded there was a 50-50 chance that Bayoumi, and by extension Saudi Arabia, had detailed advanced knowledge of the 9/11 attacks. Now, this was sat on until, I believe it was 2021, when the Biden administration released a tranche of Operation Encore documents. But the point is this spy talk released court filing, it has all sorts of information on how, yes, the CIA had a relationship, a liaison relationship with Hazmi and Midar via the Saudi intelligence services. Now, this raises all sorts of questions, namely, why did it take so long for this to be confirmed? The filing offers some explanation for this, which is that the CIA and the FBI just lied, despite well knowing about this rather dark handshake, which raises the obvious prospect that the pair, if not other hijackers, were working for the CIA on the day of the attacks. Now, I would recommend your listeners read my article and indeed the hyperlinked court filing in full, because it is full of completely dynamite disclosures and that kind of beg for a reinvestigation of who knew what and about 9/11 in advance, but also, yes, whether there was some degree of direction and control over the hijackers, whether they knew or didn't know, by the CIA. It's all quite extraordinary, but if nothing else, we know for a fact now that yes, that there was a relationship with two of the hijackers. The CIA sought to conceal this for reasons unclear. I think more widely it's kind of remarkable that, I mean, I remember very well, you know, where I was and what I was doing on 9/11 when I was 12, But the entire event has been rather forgotten. I mean, this was
there are memory holes in this the stuff that they've known about and they've just kind of forgotten it. I mean, you mentioned in the article about Hani Hajour, he had a demonstrably bad record of flying, and yet here he is executing the perfect downwards corkscrew flight into the Pentagon with precision that cast the majority of the vast majority of pilots don't possess the skill to accomplish, and yet he was able to do it on September 11th. And, you know, like one of the many conflicting narratives that we have, your term memory hold in the past 20 years.
Yeah, and I think that like Hanjour is, I mean, I would suggest, and that's what my investigation concludes, was a very likely candidate for another 9/11 hijacker who was working for the CIA. Now, I mean, you know, the mainstream media has reported on the oddity of Hanjour being the worst flight school pupil that his teachers had ever seen. He went in written exams, he would take hours to answer a question that students typically completed in just 20 minutes. He was unable to control a single engine Cessna during practical tests. And the sense among the teachers with whom he crossed paths was he shouldn't be in the air under any circumstances. Now, yes, as you mentioned, he performs this perfect descending corkscrew turn about 330 degrees from around 7,000 feet in the air while travelling over 500 miles per hour to come perfectly level with a pedestrian road leading up to the Pentagon, flying just over a metre above the ground, knocking over lampposts en route, and then crashing into a wing of the Pentagon, which is disused. The only people killed were largely maintenance workers who were reconstructing this section of the Pentagon. There were no senior staff harmed in this. And yes, this raises the very obvious question of what the hell actually happened, because the official story of the worst pilot trainee his teachers had ever seen doing this seems not only implausible but impossible. And I mean, this is a door that a large number of people, including, I might add, people within independent media, don't want opened, because it raises all sorts of crazy questions about, you know, what were the planes being remotely flown? Was it actually not a plane at all, but something rather different, such as a missile? I think that yes, that there is an aversion to exploring this stuff because it is speculative. And I can understand that as someone who works overwhelmingly based on primary source documentary evidence in the form of leaked and declassified files. Those explanations do seem, you know, rather more compelling and plausible than Hanjour flying it himself. Now, I mean, there are all sorts of other debates which, again, people don't particularly want to go near, about controlled demolition and etc. I do think at this stage, when we are 23 years removed from this, the risk of people getting into very serious trouble for probing these areas, not least because, yes, the world has kind of moved on, and this catalyzing event like a new Pearl Harbor, in the phrase of the plan for a new American century, has been rather forgotten. Mm-hmm. Despite the world-changing consequences it ushered in, this is the kind of stuff that we need to be looking at.
On the days immediately before 9/11, there were put options placed on United and American Airlines, the airplanes that were hijacked, suggesting a terrorist attack involving the airlines might happen. In an article you wrote in December of last year, you wrote about similarly strange behavior of Israeli stock immediately before October 7th, likewise suggesting a similar planned terrorist attack. Could you comment on how people other than Hamas might have profited from this knowledge, and that the government would have known, and therefore this was an attack that was allowed to happen on purpose?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I do think that I've mentioned the kind of empirical case for 9/11 being a conspiracy. The one of the most compelling things is the pointing in that direction is the fact that there was widespread, extremely suspicious trading in the months and weeks and days leading up to 9/11, which implied foreknowledge. Now there are multiple academic papers which conclude that yes, that the activity such as betting on investing large amounts of money in stocks that did well out of 9/11, such as Raytheon, the defense contractor, and betting against stocks that did badly, such as United Airlines, out of 9/11, there was an enormous amount of activity in both directions, which suggested that people knew that the attack was coming and they sought to profit from it, and they did to a large extent. I mean, to give you an example, on September 10th, 2001, which is a day before this, the purchase of Raytheon shares soared sixfold, and then a week later their value had almost doubled. So there are coincidences and there are also not coincidences, but I think that I kind of had this in mind when I read this very interesting academic study which concluded that there was suspicious trading on Israeli stocks, again both positive and negative trading, as it were, in the days preceding October 7th last year. Now, the paper has a number of very revealing graphics which show like the enormous spikes going from almost zero, if not total zero, to hundreds of thousands of trades being made in the days on Israeli stocks that were damaged by October 7th. But what's even more compelling, and again, you might be tempted to dismiss that as coincidence, is that the paper also finds similar patterns in the trading of Israeli stocks in April 2023. This is right when, and this has been reported in the mainstream media, Hamas was planning to execute what happened on October 7th originally. But they got cold feet because they sensed that the Israelis were onto them. So they dropped their plans. Now, I mean, again, this can hardly be considered a coincidence. At both times when an attack was expected and indeed an attack was executed, there is a similar level of deeply suspicious, unprecedentedly high stock market activity related to Israeli stocks. Now, this is a point that I made in my Mint Press article, which you mentioned, which is that there are new countless indications which have been confirmed in the mainstream that the Israeli military and Israeli intelligence services knew that something was coming, and I got a lot of flack in certain circles for suggesting when this began that they knew what was coming, and this has just been amply confirmed by subsequent disclosures.
Well, and there have been Egyptian intelligence, and they'd also sent information to them about the possibility of attack, and I guess Israeli Mossad. I mean, they have all sorts of transmitters all along the. I think they said something like a former IDF operative said that a cat couldn't get across without notifying it, and yet. Yeah. According to an interview I did, late in spring or something, they found they were all they were completely caught off guard. So it all seems like in terms of the position of the troops and so on and so forth. So that also sort of further corroborates the possibility that they let it happen on purpose, and that this was with the goal of. Creating this incident where they would have their own war on terrorism, so-called, right?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's like, you know, I mean, I've been covering events in Gaza and the West Bank for many, many, many years. And it's like, you know, Israel has form doing this, where there are several examples, such as in the lead up to Operation Protective Edge in 2014 or Operation Castle Edge in 2008, where the Palestinian leadership was in peace talks with Israel. And then at the very last minute, there are a series of Israeli provocations. Hamas responds with rather flaccid rocket attacks. And then this is used as a pretext for not only sabotaging peace negotiations, but carpet bombing Gaza. Now, as well, I think that you've got to bear in mind that, like, not long before this, Azerbaijani authorities carried out an almost total ethnic cleansing in Artsakh, which is was now formerly Armenian enclave within Azerbaijan. The Azerbaijanians moved in and said, well, and told the 200,000 strong population, if you don't leave immediately, we're going to massacre you all. So, of course, they left. Now, that was assisted by the Israelis, and it received not a wink of criticism in the Western mainstream at all. So we must ask ourselves, was that a motivating factor for Netanyahu to think, right, well, I'm just going to carry out my own, like, you know, total ethnic cleansing? I mean, and that is what has happened. It's, I mean, another data point within this that just sticks in my mind a lot, which is there is a veteran British client journalist called Robert Peston. He's a British journalist. He, on October 8th, published a very notable post on X or Twitter, as it was previously called, and he said that British intelligence sources had told him that that Hamas's strike on Israel the previous day was going to evolve into a full-blown regional war in West Asia, as destabilizing to global security as Putin's attack on Ukraine. And it stated that this crisis would spread well, that his intelligence sources stated that this crisis will spread well beyond the Middle East. And we are in the early stages of a conflict with ramifications for much of the world. Now, this was posted about 24 hours after Hamas breached Gaza's concentration camp walls. How did his British intelligence sources know this? Unless they wanted this to happen, were planning for this to happen, and intended for the grand regional war that they spoke of to happen. Because at that point, the Israeli government hadn't even announced a response, really, beyond dispatching Israeli occupation force operatives en masse to massacre people. There was no sense that there was going to be... I mean, we're almost a year into this, of the Israeli occupation forces going into Gaza routinely and jousting with Hamas, and, you know, it goes on and on, and it looks like Hezbollah and Israel any day now could end up in a full blown hot war. Like, you know, it's really, really, really suspicious. And I think that in a very basic way as well, Netanyahu has all sorts of domestic political problems, and including the fact that he is being investigated for corruption. The second that he's out of office, he's probably going to jail. Now, in that context, where on a micro and macro level, you feel like your time is running out, and I do think that the genocide in Gaza has exposed all sorts of structural problems within Israel, namely that it's a settler colonial population, and so that they've had a population collapse. A large number of people have fled home to the countries they're actually born in. Their economy has been ravaged by this, and, you know, they're having zero tourism, which was a big major economic sector for them. Their tech sector, because the apparent fallibility of their security systems was amply demonstrated on October 7th, are suffering big time. But these were already kind of existing issues, and I think that in terms of drawing the US deeper into this and other Western powers as a kind of grand last hurrah was Netanyahu's only option from a personal and just wider, like, geopolitical perspective. So the reasons for allowing this to go ahead couldn't be writ larger.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and my guest today is the intrepid investigative journalist and reporter Kit Clarenberg. Let's move on to another subject, the UK race riots going on in early August. There was reporting of a crime in which three children were killed and eight others injured in a savage knife attack on July 29th. Within hours, it is reported on X that someone named Ali al-Shakadi, an asylum seeker, was identified falsely as the culprit. This post was taken down within an hour, but far-right influences, most notably Tommy Robinson, jumped at this disinformation and struck attacks on mosques and Islamophobic slogans that set the stage for similar attacks all over Britain. And it should be stated that the Brits have been hit hard economically and that they are seeking, I guess, a scapegoat. You also mentioned in a month-old article how there are Zionist forces behind the situation. And let me stress, I'm not talking about Jews, but, Zionism, a nationalist movement. Can you explain this hidden Zionist role in the riots last month?
I think that it's important to note that this is a long running story which has been kind of like pushed to the fringes, but I mean the Zionist entity for decades has sought to foment discrimination, demonization, dehumanization of Muslim populations throughout the West in order to justify their genocidal settler colonial project. And they have poisoned Western information spaces from every angle through assets like Tommy Robinson for many years in order to turn people against Muslims, their Muslim neighbours. And I think that the race riots in Britain during the first weeks of August represent that pot finally boiling over. At least in Britain, I think other countries are actually further ahead on this in terms of just outright. German government officials pretty much routinely issue absolutely appalling Islamophobic statements. But the point is that Tommy Robinson, he cropped up on the public radar in 2009. Via the English Defence League. Now, they always claimed to be a non-racist, non-violent movement, but it was largely a bunch of football hooligans who had a tendency to make very racist statements. The point is that I grew up kind of around this in living in a poor, ethnically diverse area of London.
Right.
We rejected the EDL outright. But what was interesting was the EDL was very keen to flaunt its kind of diverse credentials. So it had these dedicated wings for its Greek, Hindu, Pakistani, Christian, Sikh supporters and other minority groups, the LGBT as well, of course. But the its Jewish wing was always its most visible and its most prominent. And that you always saw, a number of Israeli flags on their regular marches through British towns and cities. Now, there were two separate business entities, which is to say registered companies, set up under the EDL name, both of which contained references to the Jewish Defence League as well. Mm. Now, one of these entities had direct links with the Jewish Task Force, which is basically this far-right American organisation, which is preaches a kind of fundamentalist Zionism. They're so extreme that even its founder, a guy called Victor Vancia, has been banned from entering Israel because he was involved in bombings across the US in protest of the Soviet Union's treatment of Jews during the 1980s. But the point is that Robinson has described himself as a Zionist. He has expressed contempt and hatred for the for Palestine and the Palestinians, and he has relentlessly peddled Islamophobic myths and smears, such as the notion of the quote unquote great replacement, which is this notion that the European elites want to Islamize Europe. Right. Also, one of his very close confederates was this individual called Paul Ray, or that was his kind of pseudonym, as it were. His writing about race was cited in the manifesto of the Norwegian mass murderer Anders Breivik, who claimed that he was killing people to wake people up to the fact that there was this Muslim infiltration of Europe. Quote-unquote, Paul Ray, his real name is Paul Sonato, had a history of infiltrating the international solidarity movement in the UK. I mean, this is a pro-Palestinian campaign group which tries to get people into the occupied territories to assist with non-violent protest activities. Some of its members have been killed for this. But he infiltrated the movement and seems to have sort of, you know, destabilise and discredit them. And, I mean, bearing in mind that the international solidarity movement was on the radar of the domestic intelligence services of every country in which it operated, but also very, very specifically Mossad, because they don't want Westerners getting into the occupied territories and telling the world about what they're doing there. It seems very likely that he was directly or indirectly working for Israel in conducting this infiltration. So it very much seems that the EDL was, again, whether formally or informally, a kind of a Zionist operation from the word go. Now, I mean, in that context, it wouldn't take much for someone like Tommy Robinson to be fed talking points, to be fed directions. There was that Israeli app ACT IL, which basically did this on a grand scale, where they had dedicated WhatsApp groups where members would be told to like or share a particular tweet or attack a particular post on social media because it was critical of Israel and supportive of the Palestinians. I think that we're seeing that in real life now.
Wow, that's something. Do you have any, I don't know, just to concretize it, because you're making claims against Zionist organizations, I guess EDL, and I just want to make, you could maybe make it more concretely that this EDL, that they have full knowledge of it, because I mean they're not mentioned at all in media coverage, so.
Yeah, sure. I think that as I say, Robinson has referred to himself as a card carrying Zionist.
Yes.
And has visited the Wailing Wall and wearing a yarmulke and all this other stuff.
But they don't necessarily want to associate with him. You know what I mean? Like they could just.
Yeah, I mean, as far as I'm aware, they're intensely relaxed about that. I mean, funnily enough, Robinson distanced himself from the Jewish Defense League because one of its leaders was this woman called Roberta Moore, who went and fought with the IOF. She was the person who established links with Jewish Task Force. the fact that you would align publicly with an organization like that, that does tend to suggest that you lack the requisite self-awareness to understand or even care like how it would come across publicly, and then when there's pushback, you reverse ferret. I've written extensively about how about various Zionist lobby groups. There is a pretty consistent through line with all of this stuff that these organizations, they claim to be independent. So take, for instance, Cyberwell, which advises Meta on what should be censored on its platform and recently took credit for Meta's decision to impose restrictions on the use of the term Zionist. Their staff are a relative, are a veritable who's who of former Israeli occupation force, former Mossad, former Israeli government operatives. They claim to be completely independent and not take state funding or direction. They claim to root out anti-Semitism using artificial intelligence. But when you dig into the backgrounds of these people, it is pretty clear that they are taking directions, again, whether formal or informal, from the Israeli government or the network of organizations that it has set up to further its interests. As I say, Cyberwell claims to use AI to root out anti-Semitism on social media. Mere months before it was founded in 2021, Israel's Ministry of Strategic Affairs produced a report on combating anti-Semitism online that explicitly stated that artificial intelligence should be used for this purpose. So, I mean, maybe it's a coincidence, or indeed maybe this completely independent non-profit organization, which doesn't receive any state funding or direction, was set up as a result of this report. There is always a very murky web of operatives. It's usually quite incestuous as well. You have, you know, people tied to two or three or even more of these allegedly completely independent organizations which are fulfilling Israel's wishes and interests overseas. We should be extremely careful about this, because frequently the mainstream media is all too willing to take the line that, oh well, this is an independent organization. We see this as well with US and Israeli and British funded media outlets in countries of interest to these imperial nations, where their reporting, which is directed and funded by London and Washington and Tel Aviv, will be picked up by the New York Times and framed as the work of an independent outlet in the region, when what they mean is a propaganda platform with a history of publishing false information.
Kit, I'd like to bring your attention to the fact that I think the first time I heard of you was in 2022, when you put out solid journalism on the Paul Mason, the left-wing journalist, yes, who was active in trying to unravel academics who were putting out different narratives about the war in Ukraine, right? I mean, this guy was actually a security state collaborator. Is that the story that in your view elevated you on the X and independent media generally?
Yeah, I mean, that does seem to be rather the ground zero for me having a wider. I mean, I think that one of the really interesting things about that time, which I will never forget, was the fact that that every single day my Twitter following would come within a few dozen followers of hitting 10,000, and then would drop down by a few hundred. And this happened pretty much every day for that entire summer. People thought I was crazy for saying this. And then, lo and behold, fast forward to the Twitter files releases, which is, you know, like when Elon Musk took over Twitter, he had journalists like Matt Taibbi go over internal documents and emails. One of the disclosures was that when a user had under 10,000 followers, Twitter engineers could throttle them without any authorization, and they had a number of mechanisms of doing this. So quite clearly there was a team working around the clock to keep me throttled, and then eventually they just gave up. And then since then it's been kind of like the floodgates in terms of my reach and whatnot. I am not a fan personally of Elon Musk, but he has certainly removed a lot of the restrictions which kept independent journalists such as myself on the absolute fringes at all times. But yeah, I mean, that story, I think it remains like evergreen, because we are now 2.5 years more into this nightmare in Ukraine, and there's no signs of letting up of smears of people who are calling for some kind of negotiated settlement, despite the fact that the situation for Ukraine is absolutely desperate. And, you know, the people at the forefront of this at the very start were people like Paul Mason, who were working off a script prepared for them by British intelligence. Paul Mason, he attempted to get the nomination for a large, for I think it was five or six Labour constituencies, and failed. He wanted to be elected as an MP, and I've said it before and will say again, if I played any role in preventing him from getting into Parliament, I consider that a lifetime achievement award, because he is really a very, very, very nasty person who was cooking up. And it wasn't just academics, it was anyone who was opposed to arming Ukraine, opposed to ramping up the proxy war. He was seeking to publicly smear them as pawns of the Kremlin or useful idiots, a phrase beloved by British intelligence. But also, he was seeking, you know, to destroy their careers with the Grey Zone. He with a British intelligence operative known as Amal Khan. They, excuse me, together they tried to cook up some completely insane scheme to have us deplatformed, to damage our ability to receive income for the investigative journalism that we do completely independently and without any state or corporate sponsorship. He was on a warpath and completely drunk on the fact that he had a contact in British intelligence who was handing him briefing notes and no doubt getting ensuring that his Twitter emanations were getting maximum coverage. He seems to have gotten rather carried away by all this and proposed Machiavellian schemes to take down independent media outlets he didn't like for expressing the quote unquote wrong opinions. That was a series of articles that I did. Now 2 years ago, they are evergreen. Everyone, please check them out, because I think that it's important to note that Paul Mason is just one man. He's just one individual within this. There has been a very concerted effort to neutralize, ostracize, demonize people who are not all in on this proxy war. It is now coming apart, but we see from the US US officials sanctioning and seeking to indict people for allegedly spreading quote-unquote Russian disinformation that the fight is certainly isn't over.
A year ago, they took you off the plane and really fielded you aggressively. I wonder if you could talk about or introduce our listeners to that subject of being a target of this collective, and what happened to you?
Sure. That was May 2023. So, there's a bit of background. I've lived in Serbia for a number of years. I got trapped here during the pandemic, and it was a good place to get trapped because they didn't lock down and they didn't have all these insane mandates. But anyway, the point is, yes, I've called Serbia home for a number of years. I flew back to the UK to visit a relative who was, from my perspective at least, like at that time, on their deathbed, and I thought that I would never see them again. I had reservations about going because the previous summer, due to my reporting on Paul Mason's leaked emails, I had a British detective email me inviting me to an interview in London to discuss the charges under the quote-unquote Computer Misuse Act, i.e. reporting on leaked information in the public interest. And so I was, to say the least, ever so slightly worried. Now, when I landed in Luton, one of the world's worst airports by some considerable margin, there was a team of armed counter-terror officers waiting for me on the tarmac. They escorted me into the airport, and I was given the option of submitting to a six-hour-long interview in which I would not have the right to silence. I would have to answer every question put to me, and I would have to hand over the pins and passcodes to my digital devices, or face arrest and a prison sentence of up to 6 months for non-compliance. So,
how many were there?
There were six of them waiting for me, and there were more in the terminal waiting for me. They'd done their homework in terms of digging into my background and my reporting. I proceeded to be interrogated very intensively for 6 solid hours. As someone who has ADHD, being stuck in a windowless, airless, extremely hot room without access to any form of contact with the outside world, without food, without water,
without access to a lawyer.
Like that was about as much fun as you can imagine. Now, like, I was asked a wide variety of questions about my political beliefs, why I write, think and say the things that I do, but also, yes, like, about specific questions about my reporting, and also just completely insane queries about my relationship, or indeed Grey Zone's relationship, with the FSB, which is to say Russia's Federal Security Service. Of course, these were ludicrous, and I almost laughingly dismissed them, I mean, as the rubbish that they were. And then I'm asked, well, why are you responding so strongly? Like, it went on forever. And I think that the what's really interesting, and this is a point I've made on Twitter, and it does bear endlessly repeating, that me getting stopped like this, it created an enormous amount of bad publicity for the British state. There were mainstream figures, including people, to their credit, with whom I'd had crossed words with in the past, who were speaking up about this and condemning it and saying it was wrong. I was invited onto mainstream news networks in the US and other countries to talk about what happened to me. There were celebrities tweeting about my detention. I thought that this might be some deterrent to the British state doing this to other independent journalists. Since me, they've gone after Craig Murray, the former British ambassador to Uzbekistan, who blew the whistle on CIA and MI6 complicity in torture in that country. They've gone after Richie Medhurst, who is an independent journalist, mainly reporting on Gaza. He was, like myself, had a team of officers waiting for him when he flew into Heathrow. He was outright arrested and thrown in a cell for 24 hours as a result of this. And he remains on bail and must present himself back in the UK in 3 months' time. They've gone after Sarah Wilkinson, another independent journalist covering Palestine. This is like some meek, mild, maybe not meek and mild in terms of her reporting, but like, she is just a very sweet middle-aged woman who had a team of a dozen balaclavaed counter-terror officials kick in her door, arrest her, and she was initially released from this with bail conditions that stated that she couldn't use a laptop, a phone, or the internet. I mean, quite how she was expected to do any work or function as a human being with these restrictions isn't clear. Thankfully, by the grace of God, they have been undone. And she's back covering the genocide in Gaza. The British authorities, it seems at this point, are drunk with power and completely unconcerned about the negative publicity arising from their heavy-handed treatment. To say the least, I am unenthused about returning to the UK ever again. If needs must, I might consider it. But for the time being, I'm very happy in Serbia, where I might add as well, for all of the brickbats which are hurled at this country and its people, who I consider to be, fundamentally decent, to put it mildly, there was national outcry here. When I got stopped, there's a very prominent TV show run, which is, I think it's the most watched news show in the country. And when the host, who's regarded as a bit of a national treasure, his name is Marriage, found out about this, he was like, this is an absolute disgrace and the world must know about it. And he like pretty much demanded that I come on to talk about what had happened to me. And so it's like, and I had political parties and press organisations here talk up in my favour. Now, I think that's a very, it is a huge disparity with the British response, where the National Union of Journalists initially issued a statement in solidarity with me, but then deleted it due to backlash. There were a number of mainstream figures who did justify what happened to me and claimed that it was, yes, legitimate and right that it was done. And so, yeah, the Britain I grew up in, what prided itself on being, you know, a land of freedom and the birthplace of liberal democracy. We are very far from that right now.
Is there, in some sense, is it deliberate to get the media on board so that anybody who's thinking about putting out, inconvenient messaging or whatever, this is what you're up against, okay? And also the fact that maybe they're trying to change the way media is reporting on this stuff. I mean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I do think that the British media in general is extraordinarily bad, and co-opted. But yeah, I do think that there is a sense of intimidation. There is a belief that this will create a chilling effect. I would like to think that this is wrong-headed and erroneous, because I think a large number of people, including people who would otherwise be, very quiet, passive, complacent liberals, have had enough of all of this. Europe is collapsing economically. Its political system is producing parties and candidates who are completely indistinguishable from one another. People want something different, and they also can see very plainly the repression and abuse and brutality that's being meted out to anyone who dares deviate from the state line. I mean, you look at Germany, where there are videos of armoured riot police is beating young girls because they are walking around with Palestine flags. People are being prosecuted in that country and others for Palestine solidarity, for exercising their basic free speech, freedom of assembly rights, the very hard-fought and hard-won freedoms. And so I think that actually, rather than deterring people, it is radicalizing people further, because they can actually see the systems in which they've been living are not what they've been told they are. They are considerably more repressive than they've been led to believe. People are looking for alternatives. A feel-good story out of the last UK election in July was the fact that several completely independent candidates who didn't have any real presence in the mainstream and had no money got elected to Parliament on explicit Palestine solidarity platforms. So it's usually right when repressive power structures are on the brink of collapse that they become their most repressive. It is a shame we have to live through that period of it, but the long-term view is a lot brighter than it might seem now. I like to think, anyway.
Okay, well, Kit Klarenberg, I'm afraid we've come right to the end of our time, but I really enjoyed our conversation, and we'll have to arrange to have you on more frequently in the not too distant future, if that's okay. But thank you for
absolutely
your time.
God okay. Bless you. God bless you, Michael, and God bless you, everyone. Take care. Bye bye.
Okay. Bye. Thanks. And Kit Klarenberg is an investigative journalist exploring the role of intelligence services in shaping politics and perceptions. He hosts the YouTube podcast Active Measures with Alex Rubinstein, and he joined us from his home in Serbia.
And just a final note, you can dig into Kit's many discussions at the website kitklarenberg.com. That's kitklarenberg.com. Next week, tune in for an elaborate conversation about the little-discussed summit of the future at the next annual UN General Assembly meeting and other developments by Gates, Rockefeller, and company that could radically alter the status of people around the world. Join us in 7 days. We're
listening to the Global Research News Hour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us.